Hello, and welcome to another episode of MK Crypto Diaries. I am your host, Dr. Justine Sherrera, and we are recording today's episode on the 18th of April, 2023. Today, we will be speaking about all things crypto and AML related, and we are conveniently recording this episode on the evening of the vote of MiCA and the vote of the transfer of funds regulation. So, what is the travel rule? What is the transfer of funds regulation and its effect? Who are these new regulations applying to? Now, is there such a need for a thing called DeFi compliance? And if so, what adopted viable product market fit tools are currently available in the market? Here with us to discuss all current regulatory affairs centered around AML and crypto, we have with us Adam Vaziri. Adam Vaziri is the co-founder of BlockPass, and BlockPass is a portable KYC and identity system for the cryptocurrency industry. So Adam, thank you so much for joining us today to speak about all things AML and crypto, and let's get right into it. So firstly, Adam, can you you're very welcome. Can you please tell us a bit about yourself, why you founded BlockPass, and also what BlockPass's role is in the cryptocurrency space?
Yeah, sure. So my training is as a lawyer. I qualified as a lawyer back in 2010 in London. And then I started working in fintech in the early stages of kind of its emergence within London. Around 2013, I discovered Bitcoin. And at that point, I decided to create, at the time, I think it was the only dedicated shop for all things from a regulatory nature for crypto. And at that very early stage of 2013, it was really only Bitcoin at the time. There were some altcoins. And what I saw was really that there's a disconnect with how the technology works and what the expectations are from a regulations standpoint. And what was needed is a way of bridging the divide between the two. So for a couple of years, I was working on policy. I set up one of the first associations at the time. It's called the UK Digital Currency Association, mm-hmm. which after the Bitcoin Foundation was probably the most influential at the time association. Then we're doing some policy work around, you know, taxation of Bitcoin, the regulatory infrastructure, et cetera, AML laws as applied to VASPs, what became to be known as VASPs. At the same time, in parallel, I was working with startups to help them get effectively set up in a compliant fashion. Mm-hmm. So even though the regulations may have been somewhat ambiguous, from my point of view, I mean, it's not really rocket science. You know, there are AML laws that are in place, sanctions are in place, regardless mm-hmm. of whether you're using crypto or selling shoes. It doesn't really matter. You still got to comply. And so it's very much about putting those frameworks in place and making sure that they could at least achieve some degree of legal certainty on the projects that they were doing. Some of those projects I actually obtained licenses for. It was set up the first money remittance system regulated mm-hmm. by the FCA called BitPesa, and that was settling mm-hmm. in Bitcoin and not through the SWIFT system. So that's mm-hmm. quite interesting.
Sounds like M-Pesa, the Kenyan one.
yeah, that's right. They were settling into M-Pesa. Uh-huh. That's exactly mm-hmm. right. Set up the first regulated lottery that was in the Isle of Man. It took 2 years to get the license. Mm. And that was fully on Ethereum, a smart contract, and set up the first derivatives exchange. That was crypto facilities. It's the first really fully regulated crypto derivatives exchange mm-hmm. on Bitcoin. Bitcoin in, Bitcoin out, no fiat, kind of like BitMEX, but at the time just fully regulated. You got that authorized by the FCA. So I was interested in, like, how do you take a crypto business and how do you get it licensed? How do you make it official? How do you give them legal certainty? That was really my mm-hmm. my mission at the time. And BlockPass is really just an extension of that. BlockPass is essentially the platform to make it possible for crypto businesses to comply in a way that they don't really have to think about it. They can, you know, just go to our website, set up an account, and start onboarding in a compliant fashion their users. and not only adhering with to, you know, KYC AML standards, but also dealing with, you know, emergent areas of regulation such as travel, etc. So that's what BlockPass is. It hopes to be a kind of one-stop shop for the crypto industry from a compliance standpoint.
Amazing. And that's a really varied, holistic background. It sort of does tie into each other. You said money remittances, derivatives, dealing with various regulators, and then sort of rolling into crypto compliance, and then realizing there's a sort of a product market gap specifically in terms of crypto AML compliance. And obviously there's a lot of movement in terms of AML, new regulations worldwide, specifically when it comes to FATF and also the EU. So it all started, I would say, that in terms of regulation and crypto, with the travel rule coming out of FATF. Could you please, for the benefit of our listeners, clarify exactly who FATF are, what this crypto travel rule is, and who it applies to?
Yeah, so Financial Action Task Force is a supranational organization, like many supranational organizations as member states, and they develop policy. That policy is a set of standards effectively around AML, which then cascade into actual implemented pieces of law legislation within the member states. And then the role of FATF is to audit those countries to see if mm-hmm. they're actually adhering to those standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, crypto came on its radar fairly early and started to develop some, you know, policies around that, research into it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not like something new that they've introduced their, you know, travel. They've already had a number of other policy papers prior to that around how crypto should be captured by AML regulations. So really, I mean, in a nutshell, if FATF introduces a recommendation, then most likely, you know, mm-hmm. it will apply at least throughout the Western world and across its member states. And so what's the travel rule? Like, travel rule effectively, you know, the notion here is you have regulated financial institutions. When you have a transaction goes from mm-hmm. one institution to the other, that in that message, you also have the sender and beneficiary details
mm-hmm.
So that the recipient institution knows where the money's come from effectively. That's where the essence of the rule comes from. That already applies within the fiat world, so to mm-hmm. speak. And the travel rule as applied to crypto is an adaptation of that requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it exist? There are certain reasons. One such region is sanctions compliance. Sanctions compliance, for instance, Standard Chartered, interestingly enough, was fined, you know, a humongous fine from New York's Department of Finance, you know, Supervisory mm-hmm. Authority, for breaching sanctions. Why? Mm-hmm. Because they were kind of dissimulating the origin of the transaction. So they're routing transactions that involve Iranian beneficiaries
mm-hmm.
and breaching sanctions law in the US. And so really what they're trying to establish is like a clear line of communication around who the sender beneficiary is and mm-hmm. for that data to transit from one BAS, one regulated BAS mm-hmm. to another BAS.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the travel was seeking to achieve. So that the recipient BAS, so the receiver has that data to hand. Now in practice, it's a very different story of how you implement that and how you raise the bar, so to speak, across the industry, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But the essence of it is the communication of the sender beneficiary mm-hmm. details.
Mm-hmm. And also the threshold I saw was much lower. So I believe it's about 1,000 for crypto, which is less than the fiat world, because in the fiat world, it's 10,000 and the crypto world, it's 1,000. Right.
Yeah, but I think it's just a broad categorization of crypto as being mm-hmm. High risk.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the analogy is cash. You know, you have
yes.
you know, the treatment is as a bearer instrument. Like if you had cash,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you don't really necessarily know the origin, so
exactly.
you can't really trace it back mm-hmm. so many hops. You can see the action on the blockchain, but you can't necessarily tether it to an identity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, when we're saying that sort of who it applies to, so obviously CASPs and BASPs. So even if they're receiving a crypto transaction from a non-custodial wallet, they'll have to verify where it's coming from. So obviously, this is also an obligation which is transferred to DeFi. And that's why this space has become a bit complex and even more controversial because of the pure fundamentals, which we'll get into a bit later on. On this topic of the travel rule, I recently read something called the sunrise issue when it comes to the travel rule. This meaning that some countries where they have complied with the travel rule, the sun has risen. And in those countries where they haven't complied with the travel rule yet, the sun has not yet risen. Can you please explain the reason for this, why it is problematic, and sort of certain issues that service providers face due to these sort of sunrise issues and challenges?
Yeah, I think it is a challenging environment for a start, because, you know, the thing about standards, I mean, this is just a question about standards, is if you have a standard that has not yet been adopted by everyone, then it's not really a standard.
Exactly.
You know, basically.
So basically, even though there are these recommendations, member states sort of can decide when and how to implement them, to go beyond, to go less, to, you know, to actually put them in to force but not enforce anything. So
it's,
all this fragmentation.
You know, I guess it's an analogy of, you know, maybe what it was like in the 80s to put into place, you know, into intergovernmental, you know, body that can coordinate AML laws and then cascade it. I mean, in a sense, it's like starting from scratch because there's nothing to build upon.
Yes. Because that's the thing, if you're operating in a jurisdiction where they have implemented this travel rule and therefore you have put these safeguards or compliance requirements into force, but then you have certain partnerships or interact with certain exchanges regulated in other jurisdictions who don't have the FATF rule travel recommendations in place, then sort of, do you not deal with those parties? Do you deal with those parties because they're regulated, but it's not your sort of fault that their country hasn't implemented? So like the challenges surrounding that are sort of, how do, you know, providers deal with that?
Yeah, I think it's very complicated because there's no guidance really around that. But, you know, you got issues around data protection. So, for example, let's say, I don't know, I'm based in the jurisdiction where travel does apply, and I wish to send data to another VASP in a jurisdiction where at the moment it doesn't apply. And maybe that VASP is not even regulated. So what am I doing? I'm sending personal data on one of my customers to a company that's not necessarily accountable in, to the same degree as myself. So it's a bit of an issue, I would say, that side of things, because if you don't send the data, then you're not complying with your own requirements. If you do send the data, then you've got, you know, data protection risk there. So then the only way of mitigating it is the due diligence on your counterparty. So who are you doing business with? Okay, that jurisdiction is not a requirement yet to comply with the travel rule, but I've got to transit the data. I better do my due diligence on who I'm sharing this data with.
Yes.
And can I get any cast iron guarantees around how they're processing that data? So I think there's like one side of it is data protection and the other side is the AML compliance, because, you know, essentially, if you're just sending the data willy-nilly, at a certain point, you know, you're going to get end into a, you know, you're essentially flouting data protection requirements. Because there's one side of it, which is, okay, well, you can use AML as a public defense, you know, in the case of transfer of data to a third party. You know, you can justify it on that basis, that it's a lawful transfer of data. But, you know, when it comes down to the proportionality of the action and reasonableness and the standard contract clauses that you would normally have, say, with a non-compliant data protection jurisdiction, can you adhere with those requirements? Like even the US is not an equivalent jurisdiction when it comes to GDPR. So there are complexities, and the data protection aspects is where it gets more complex. But I think it does boil down to common sense. I mean, are you really going to share customer data with an exchange that you have no idea who they are? And you're just going to, you know, just send an email to them and just say, hey, you know what? Here's passport details of JBlogs. Of course you're not. You know, I think to a certain degree, it's common sense how people think about implementing these rules.
Of course, case by case basis as well. So, all right, perfect. And if I had to move to a sort of more current note in the AML regulatory sphere, so tomorrow, because today we are recording on the 18th of April, tomorrow, the 19th of April, the EU Parliament will be voting on MiCA, which is obviously a massive crypto asset regulation, which every single person in the sector is speaking about, but also voting on the transfer of funds regulation. Can you please elaborate and explain exactly what this transfer of funds regulation is and what it's regulating exactly?
Yeah, a transfer of funds regulation is just an implementation of the travel. That's just the regulations that implement the travel principle.
The same recommendations of FATF. The same recommendations of FATF from the TFR.
Yeah. And whereas MiCA is, you know, a comprehensive framework for virtual assets. You know, the transfer of funds is more just purely on that AML front around travel compliance.
Okay. And in terms of the TFR, the travel rule, the travel and fund regulation, from the interpretation of the text, in your opinion, will there be any implications for NFT platforms and for DAOs and DeFi? And if yes, can you elaborate a bit on these implications?
I think it's a bit tricky. I need to actually see the text when it's published because there's a lot of speculation around the scope. And also there's cross-referencing. So what is a CASP? You know, it's cross-referenced into MiCA, you know, the definitions cross-referenced. So, in principle, the framework applies to CASPs, which are VASPs. These are service providers in the sense of a legal entity. There's a legal entity. Now, one of the requirements is that there is a legal entity for there to be a CASP. Like you can't, for instance, have an informal partnership or act as a sole trader. So from my point of view, at least, to an extent, DeFi is outside of scope. However, I think if you're an NFT issuer, you really should be thinking about compliance at this stage, because there are numerous reasons why you would be wanting to adhere to some degree of AML KYC compliance. There's not only a technical consideration of whether you are or not within scope, but it's also just which way is the wind blowing at the moment.
Definitely.
If you're just gonna issue NFTs and not care where the money's coming from, I think you're just you're a little bit desensitized maybe to the amount of regulatory news there is at the moment. So I think it's ill-advised for anyone really in that game to be ignoring basic KYC procedures. Now, do they need to do unhosted wallet KYC? I think that's a technical question of whether they are or not within scope of the transfer funds regulations. So, but that said, it really, really the compliance associated with that is really not that heavy. It's not heavy. I mean, for example, BlockPass, we built the solution. It's really like from the user experience point of view, it's not that difficult. I mean, they sign the wallet, send the message, check the message is signed, and that's it. There's really nothing more to it. So I don't think it's so onerous, frankly.
Okay. I would say in terms of if the DeFi tools have to comply with these AML regulations, FATF, TFR, etc., it depends on the DeFi product or non-custodial wallet themselves. So if they want to interact with regulated exchanges, which are going to have to be compliant with this TFR and FATF, then they have no choice but to implement some sort of verification. It could be an open API with BlockPass or like a protocol embedded verification tool or whatever it is. They can obviously decide to remain DeFi and not interact with regulated exchanges. And then obviously they won't have the obligation. So it really depends on them. But if they do decide to comply, which rolls into my next question. So in terms of challenges, so many argue that certain software products were not built or programmed with this AML compliance considerations in mind, and therefore finding it very challenging to implement such considerations. In terms of DeFi compliance, which wasn't really a thing or not at all till very recently, what sort of good real product market fit tools are available on the market? So obviously, Blockbus does service crypto industry, and if I am a non-custodial wallet and I want to comply with the travel rule to be able to interact and send or receive transactions with a crypto exchange, like technically and operational, how do you make that happen?
Yeah, well, first I'd like to say that there is a clear somewhat bifurcation between, you know, the regulations that are going to be imposed on the centralized, you know, operators, the CAS, the VASPs, you know, the obvious ones, right? And then what happens to DeFi? I don't think, for example, like Mika directly applying to the likes of Uniswap or the likes,
definitely not, I agree.
Or, you know, transfer of funds regulations directly applying, you know, to one of those tools. I don't see that. I see that there's still the opportunity from a policy standpoint, to argue a case whereby DeFi does not need to re-centralize in order to comply, that it can remain in somewhat of a relative decentralized state. And you say relative because it really depends on the project as to whether you qualify as a decentralized or not. So even that's, you know, to an extent, the use of decentralized, the word, It's sometimes a bit of a euphemism.
I agree.
You don't really know what it means. Like if it's genuinely decentralized to a certain degree, then you could make the case that there's a policy argument for a new type of regulatory framework, which could be, for example, make sure you comply with sanctions. So that could be just because, I mean, in any event, you have to comply with sanctions. So there's no choice. Yeah.
So the OFAC tornado mixer case in point, we're saying we don't care that you're defiling just the protocol, we're going to sanction you. So regardless of how or what you do it, unfortunately, the reality is that somehow you have to create a culture of compliance to some degree, even if it's the tiniest, smallest degree.
And to achieve that, I think, there are different ways of doing that. So one such way is, you know, by making the identity verification components, all of that anonymous and decentralized themselves. So, for example, you can interact with the protocol, but you know that everyone within the pool has gone through minimum checks, sanction screening, things like that. Now, everyone might turn around and say, well, you know, I'd love to, you know, trade with North Korean arms dealers.
Yes.
They would turn around and say that. I don't know. I've kind of lost kind of where the culture is going in crypto. But, you know, there is definitely this us versus them attitude at the moment. But for the pragmatists that don't, you know, want to spend the rest of their life in an orange jumpsuit, for those that are operating within DeFi, they can say, we'll introduce a few tools to ensure both front-end, back-end compliance with some basic requirements, sanction screening, absolutely no questions asked, whether it's country level, individual level. I mean, that's kind of a prerequisite if you want to have a viable policy. I'm talking about from a policy standpoint. And then there are stuff that the French regulators have been talking about, which is like software certification, things like that, certified, because you never know in DeFi, it's so decentralized that it could all just be a rug pull, you know, it could be like luring you in to get your money and then take it. So this has to be some degree of accountability within these projects because it's being used by everyone. When you have that in mind, you can't just say, oh, buyer beware. Buyer cannot beware when the buyer doesn't know anything. And it's just, you know, aping along and getting involved in what everyone else is doing.
Yes.
So, you know, that's why investor protection exists. So there's that side of things, which I view to be an opportunity from a policy standpoint. And I think the jury's still out. I mean, for the US, it's a different story because they're really on the they're backpedaling.
They're in a league of their own, I would say.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, for me, I think it's like, you know, the US took like 3 steps forwards and now it's taking 10 steps back, and that's
yes,
I don't think that's going to stop. So I think US is just doing its thing, because, you know, the FTX meltdowns caused so much embarrassment that no one's really going to be able to present a viable alternative around, you know, policy in crypto. But Europe is an opportunity because, you know, Europe hasn't been burnt yet. That's basically it.
It's true.
To be put it blunt. So there's an opportunity, and, you know, the Brussels effect, you know, the standardization, the kind of emanating standards, that may in the long run yield to kind of a more pragmatist approach in the US. So on the centralized side, how do you comply from an unhosted wallet point of view? It's very straightforward, as I mentioned. Like, for the unhosted wallet, the way that they would interact with the exchange says, okay, well, I will allow you to withdraw to your Ledger wallet, to your, you know, whatever the wallet is, but I need to verify that you own that wallet. So how do I make that determination? First, I need to know that you need to prove to me that you own the wallet. So that can be done by technical means. They can just sign a message, verify the signature. Yeah. That's sufficient. And then in addition to that, I need to know that wallet belongs to you, because you can sign it. I don't want to know it's you.
And what about if the transaction is not coming from your wallet? So if you have an account on whatever, Binance, let's say, which is regulated in a European jurisdiction, and you want to receive a transaction which is coming from a non-custodial wallet, which isn't yours. So the verification doesn't do it, and you actually need to have other information or documentation. Do you deal with those sort of solutions as well?
Oh yeah. I mean, third-party transfers among non-custodial wallets, totally possible. Not complicated at all. But the reality is, no exchange is going to accept a third-party transfer. Let's be honest about it. Like, no one's going to, like, if I was in the compliance team of Binance, I would not, I would, as a policy question, I would say no third-party transfers into the exchange when it's non-custodial, because, you know, they could be receiving the transaction from anywhere. They need to KYC the sender. They need to understand the purpose of the transaction. Why is this dude sending money into your account in Binance? You know, it's too complicated. First party and, you know, closed loop is the norm. So I think that's somewhat unlikely. So I think on the first party stuff, it's just, I need to know, like, if I'm operating an exchange, I need to know that that's Joe Bloggs' wallet, you know, that's all.
Yes.
How do I determine that? I get a third party to do KYC him with his wallet, and then I, you know, check the API, and it tells me, oh, it's Joe Bloggs, and it's his wallet. And that's it, really.
We haven't gotten to phase two yet. So if you have an account on a regulated exchange, and imagine I want to pay you X amount of money, but I want to pay you from my MetaMask, you would say that right now, because there's no solutions on the market to be able to make that happen, to be able to comply with the regulations there is, that's from that standpoint, it's sort of a bit impossible.
No, it's totally possible. It's just, I don't think, if I'm putting myself in the shoes of a compliance officer within a centralized exchange, I see no benefit allowing a third party transfer into the exchange from a non-custodial wallet. I see no benefit to me, the exchange. Yes, like, if it's coming from Kraken, whatever, like from another exchange, then I kind of have to accept it. But if it's coming from a third party, I don't have to accept it. Because if I say it's coming from Kraken, well, it's coming from your account on Kraken, not from a third party account. Now, if I want to accept third party transfers, I need to be ready for it. And I don't think it's about technology here when it comes to third-party transfers. It's about compliance procedures, because you're dealing with a more complicated workflow.
Yes.
And you need to understand the rationale for these third-party transfers each time that those transfers occur. So I just can't see it in the short term. In the long term, yes, if the you know, exchanges start to become comfortable with the rule, and at that point, yeah, it's very straightforward. If you have an unhosted wallet, for example, let's say you were going to top up my account on Binance using your MetaMask wallet, what happens is Binance would just send you a link to BlockPass. You do the KYC with BlockPass, sign a message to show that you own the wallet. Binance then checks the API with BlockFast. We say, yes, it belongs to Justine. And then that, the transaction goes through.
Mm-hmm.
They've already got the data on the sender. So the travel compliance is already in place. So the technical means are already in place, and we've already had the solution for nearly a year. So that's not a big deal. But it's from a compliance standpoint, I think they're just going to stick to first-party transfers.
Agreed. But also, like, since you cannot really reject a transaction to your wallet, so anyone can send anyone a transaction. So in that case, it's sort of uncontrollable as well. Maybe, I don't know if there are some ways and means where these exchanges can not allow any transactions coming from unverified wallets, because we're dealing with, maybe you would know, because I don't.
I honestly think, like, it depends on the policy of the exchange, but if they can't verify the source, they'll just send it back. You can't verify the source, send it back, subject to, you know, any other kind of suspicious activity reporting that they may need to be.
Okay, it makes sense. Okay, and sort of keeping with this us versus them, where many, you know, crypto enthusiasts don't have that culture of compliance yet or willingness. So many DeFi enthusiasts believe that implementing such measures, so AML, KYC measures for non-custodial products and services, goes against the very fundamentals of crypto. Case in point, in recent news, Trezor, which is a non-custodial wallet, moved to implement an ownership verification protocol called Ownership Proof of Protocol, or AOPP, to be able to interact with CASPs or VASPs. But due to a backlash from the crypto community, it decided to remove this feature. Now, I'm just going to read an extract from the Bitcoin Insider. So the Trezor hardware wallet introduced AOPP signing as part of its latest January update last week. Obviously last week, so 3 months ago, allowing users to generate signatures that conform to the AOPP standard used in certain jurisdictions. On January 28th, Trezor announced that it will remove this protocol in the next Trezor Suite update after, quote-unquote, careful consideration of recent feedback. Recent feedback refers to Reddit and Twitter users who were concerned that the use of the AOPP signaled Trezor's support for greater regulation and a complete disregard for a potential loss of privacy. Furthermore, the same article states that the hardware wallet maker claimed it is against the regulations that concern AOPP, namely the data leak risks associated with using a stringent identification process like Know Your Customer or KYC to buy Bitcoin. Now, what are your sentiments about this type of reaction? So I believe that Trezor nearly lost 95% of its user of its users after this announcement. So obviously they had no choice to remove it, or basically they're not going to remain in existence. So obviously it's a very controversial sort of topic. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, they're in the cold wallet business, have been since the beginning, and that's probably as decentralized as you can be, frankly. You know, you can't really compare, like, the requirements on Trezor to a company like Coinbase or whatever. So, they're in the business of providing hardware and open source, wallets, effectively, or, interacting with open source wallets. So, I mean, I totally understand their rationale, and I sympathize with those that, view this as countercultural. Mm-hmm. I sympathize, but for anyone that's been in compliance, worked in the regulatory space, it's just the writing has been on the walls for 10 years. I mean, I've been sitting and observing and waiting, because I knew it's going to come. So I don't think it's really a surprise. Of course, whether it's a surprise or not, it doesn't mean you cannot oppose it. If you want to oppose it, you can. Probably wasn't a surprise, but they just, want to resist this initiative.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally get it.
Okay.
I think fundamentally it just boils down to whether you think that the project can be sufficiently decentralized to sit outside of, that a regulatory space. And The fact is, I mean, I remember, I mean, if I'm being frank about it, the early days of crypto, I remember, you know, mining Bitcoin on a laptop. You know, there was a time when like the individual had some impact within crypto and that there was an excitement or even romanticism around what this technology meant. But then that translated into, to be frank, greed and trading. And with that came a completely different culture, which was, I would say, a culture of, a culture of greed. And I think in, in that kind of environment, that's how you end up with all of these different trading platforms, and you know, the likes of Luna. You know, I don't think that certainly was a surprise when you see, you know, how everyone's been pushing the envelope in terms of what they could do from a regulatory arbitrage standpoint, and all in the name of decentralization. So, like, I believe there's a genuine cause for decentralization. But it's not reflected in those that are trading crypto day in, day out. And they're two different sectors of the population. And I don't think one is as, let's say, bona fide as the other.
I love how you put it. So we went from romanticization, utopian vision, to greed, to certain downfalls of the industry. I think it's a really true picture of the evolution of the space. However, although I do agree with you, there are some serious viable concerns. So in terms of my next question, so many in the cryptocurrency community have expressed concerns about these AML measurements, stating that since the blockchain is already a public network, sharing personal information behind an unhosted wallet will reveal the complete transaction history of that client, surpassing much more than the amount of information that the traveler will collect from traditional financial institutions. So if there is a vulnerability, one can obtain the entire financial history and wealth of a person. So would you agree with the stance, and do you think that regulators are aware of the potential dangerous consequential effects of these regulations due to the nature of the blockchain? And do you think, lastly, that specific DeFi AML rules should have been made to leverage the positive characteristics of the blockchain as a technology itself, instead of applying a one-size-fits-all, you know?
Look, my view on this is, like, the area that I am most interested in is areas of innovation within compliance, not necessarily just following the rules, but how those rules can be innovated. But the problem is, when the industry has faced so many challenges in terms of credibility, it makes it more challenging from a compliance standpoint and policy standpoint to come back and introduce something that's a compromise. That said, so I mean, there are ways. Like for example, as I mentioned, you know, why do I need to give you the data on me? Why can't I just prove to you that I'm not sanctioned, not from this jurisdiction, and not? It's totally possible. There are things called zero knowledge proofs. We already do that within BlockPass. You know, these kind of technologies already exist to minimize the amount of data that's being transferred. Another aspect of it is, frankly, if you're so concerned about the holistic view on your crypto wallet, just create another wallet. You know, if you read the white paper, the Satoshi white paper, he says, you know, this is an issue, aggregation into a single wallet address. So most likely to preserve their privacy, they'll create, I'm paraphrasing, but you create a wallet per transaction. So that's a question of software, I think, and use. I mean, of course, Ethereum is different because it's an account-based system. So everything is just lumped into one account. But, you know, even in Ethereum, you could, you know, structure things in it, you know, separating out your assets, et cetera. But I don't think that's the crux of it. I think the crux of it is just delivery of data, you know, just sending your data out and not really knowing where it's going to end up and feeling uncomfortable about that fact. And the fact that crypto was kind of the last bastion of privacy that, you know, humans were granted privacy over their money, that human were granted. And to an extent, and that was kind of the original culture. But of course, that's changed somewhat. But you know, I think for people that they feel that somewhat heartfelt, you know, to now have to like deliver up their data, and without a guarantee that it's going to be fully protected, because you know, who can guarantee that? And you know, this once it goes into a VASP, then that VASP has got that data, and then it's going to be passed on to another VASP, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a totally legitimate concern. Although I think there are ways of mitigating it through like additional address creation and software that can make that process easier. But also the reality is on the policy level, it just really needs a coordinated approach in order to present innovative solutions that can be a compromise. You know, like when we were originally conceiving of kind of a regulatory framework back in 2013, this is going back a long time, you know, 10 years ago. The first thing that we said was, look, we understand like the AML frameworks going to be necessary on the on and off ramps. Look, we suggest Treasury, UK Treasury, you know, just create a specific regime covering AML for the on and off ramps, right? But as it relates to you know, the risk to the customer investor related matters, the custody of funds, all of these kind of things, what we suggest is actually that the industry incepts a standard, so a self-regulatory organization or something of that nature, because it's a flexible approach. And then you get more grassroots ideas on how you can achieve a certain objective without it being, you know, taking a top-down approach. I mean, you know, Switzerland, they have the SRO, but I mean, it'd be good to understand, kind of get some data from it as to how they address kind of regulatory requirements and how they can look at it from a grassroots standpoint from the industry up. How can we address this? Is if you're closer to the industry, then you can come up with innovative solutions. The question is whether or not they're going to, you know, be signed off as being sufficient. But, you know, that's the way we saw it. But I think now that, you know, that there's a lot of pressure to on the industry now to just comply. And that's
No, it makes complete sense. So obviously, because of the loss of credibility, you know, it's hard to compromise on certain things. But you're saying, as you said, there are certain great solutions like zero knowledge proofs, which are being widely adopted throughout the industry. And I like the way you close that, you know, the industry should look at, or regulators and policymakers more than the industry should look at, receiving the same objective, but potentially through different means. So if there are certain characteristics of the blockchain which can be used and leveraged, then so be it. So as long as the same outcome is achieved, you know, it can be through different means. So this all boils down to what's going to be passed as legislation, what interpretations can be changed, and future regulations. So as a sort of closing questions, do you have any projections for how we're going to see this space evolve? Do you think there's going to be a change of culture? Do you think, you know, that regulations will be amended, you know, several times in the future? Sort of, how do you see the space developing in the light of upcoming regulations?
Well, first of all, I still believe that MiCA is probably the most important piece of legislation since I've been involved in crypto. So basically since the beginning. I don't think any legislation comes anywhere close to what MiCA is going to achieve. So I genuinely believe it's an exportable standard. And yeah, I'm a bit of a Europhile to a certain extent from a personal standpoint, but I genuinely believe there's a standard there that's being developed, in the same way that electronic money, payment services, open banking, you know, these became standards. And so, yeah, and I really think no one has ever seen a genuine single market for crypto. So it's going to be fascinating to see that take shape. I really think that's just the most powerful thing, to know that you know, you can be regulated in a single jurisdiction and operate in other jurisdictions. I think it's going to be game changer for the
Mm-hmm.
crypto industry, because crypto industry has been like the structuring, you know, everything. It's all about being like regulatory arbitrage. But where are you going to go next? You know, I don't know, the Solomon Islands, you know, like, I don't know if there's a small enough island, you know, that can accommodate some of the crypto exchanges. You know, they're running out, and with climate change,
True.
you know, who knows, they'll probably run out faster than you think.
True.
So I think the fact is that regulatory arbitrage is out of the window. We're not in the early days of crypto that you can just
True.
go offshore and just not worry about it. That those days are over. Now we're in the, you know, it's regulated everywhere phase. And when you now have a single market, that changes everything, in my opinion, because it will then, you know, create a magnetic force for viable startups to establish themselves in a regional market. So I think that's really great, because you start to see, you know, projects, you know, emerge within Europe that effectively become exportable. And I think that's interesting. The second thing is the experience is going to be unrivaled. So all of the travel compliance, all of that stuff, at least within the EU, across those member states, they're going to have so much experience on, you know, coordinating that, because they can coordinate it. It's not like, you know, one state to another, but it's a coordinated approach. So I think what we're going to see, I mean, talk about Sunrise, that's going to tighten up very quickly in that region. And then you'll have a nicely harmonized approach around how the data security aspects are dealt with and things like that. So I honestly think it's another GDPR exportable standard. Then, I mean, I think the true value of MiCA is, you know, essentially giving legitimacy to the utility token, which has been like, what is it? Is it security? Is it not? These are US questions. And now MiCA said, oh no, there's a third way. You know, it's not a commodity, it's not a security, it's a, you know, utility token. So I think that still has merit today, and projects that are really genuinely involved in, you know, trying to finance their business by selling utility tokens now have a legitimate path forwards. And I'd say, considering, you know, the onslaught within crypto, the fact that they're going to sign this law in next, you know, tomorrow or whatever, well, it goes to show, you know, you know, they didn't get cold feet. They didn't turn around and say, well, oh no, after FTX, no more utility tokens. It's just like, just redact that whole section.
True.
Yeah. So I think, I think that's very bold, I would say. And I think that is the leadership is needed, because it's not the startups that are going to revitalize crypto. It's regulations right now that's going to revitalize it.
I agree.
Because, you know, as I said, like, the whole offshore thing is finished now. It's finished. I think maybe if you're offshore, if you're a fund, something like that, structuring it as a fund, maybe, or if you genuinely have a reason for being structured offshore. But now the world is regulated. And when you wake up in that new dawn, you're looking for certainty. And it sounds like, you know, the sun is rising and setting in the EU for the next few years.
No, that's a great last words. I definitely agree with you that, you know, MiCA and the TFR is going to lock in and say bye-bye to the Sunrise issue and definitely create harmonization and passporting all across Europe. I do think that due to the coordination and complexity of transposing the regulation, that there will be sort of that messy 1 or 2 years transitionary period till, you know, people figure out, oh, I have to apply, where shall I apply, the regulators and the policymakers to understand this regulation sort of will take some time. But the end result is definitely looking brighter than continents like the US for sure. So Adam, thank you so much. That was, I mean, a really insightful conversation so far as KYC and AML go in the crypto world. Before I let you go, I would just like to invite you to participate in a round of I Call Bullshit. I will read out a passage and then tell me if it's bullshit or not, or true or false, however you prefer. So, recently, the US Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin claimed that Bitcoin and other cryptos are being exploited by criminals. He said, quote, cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin have been exploited to support billions of dollars of illicit activity like cybercrime, ransomware, and tax evasion. This is indeed a national security issue. According to research published by Messari, after the publication of the statement by the US Secretary Mnuchin, the ratio between fiat to crypto when it comes to money laundering statistics is a staggering 800-1, meaning that for every $1 of BTC spent on the dark web, $800 is laundered in fiat. So do you call bullshit or not?
That sounds quite true to me.
You are right. It is actually true, even though it sounds like a crazy ratio. It is absolutely correct. So well done on getting it right. All right, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. Really insightful, as I said. And to you, our listeners, thank you very much for tuning in. And until next time.